He just stared, albeit profusely, at times. He didn't put fear into my heart. I felt more along the lines of, you make my dick as cold as the temp scientists wish would stabilize at the Arctic so half of coastal America won't eventually wash away. Yeah. Besides, if the white hipsters in the next building over were allowed to huddle up and sing their soft rock songs at all hours of the night without the threat of violence, I assumed the area was safe enough so long as I avoided certain sidewalks. Not to mention, again, that I lived in far worse settings than this. What really mattered the most to me was that the apartment itself had all of the qualities every 20-something on an intense budget who didn't want to sleep on the street looked out for. Cheap and decent. The room may have been the size of a Happy Meal box, but at least the box was in California instead of Texas. After a few months, the friend who had graciously invited me into her home turned out to be Land's answer to Ursula the Sea Witch. She became cold and distant, and our once beautiful friendship soured as time went on. We made up years later, and no matter what, I'll always love and cherish her. But that was not what I felt at the time. At the time, I was like, yo, you encouraged me to come out here only to treat me like you want to run me over with your Corolla. Twice. If no one is present to stop you from putting your car in reverse. I assumed her frustrations were rooted in the fact that she had abandoned her well-paying job in banking to pursue her dream of being a singer. She now found herself with little money and struggling to make ends meet. We were both pursuing our passions, but regrettably, we were not the cheerleaders each other could have used in those darker moments. Still, me being a recent LA transient, she was the only good friend I had in the city. All of the people I cared about had either remained in Houston or had already relocated to New York after college. My initial plan had been to join them there, but I had ended up on the left coast, lonely as hell. Fortunately, I forged a friendship with Shawnee. Shawnee was a girl whom I met through an internet message board I had wasted far too much time on over the years. This would include debating whether or not Rihanna had stolen Fifi Dobson's old clothes and clippers when she relaunched herself with the Good Girl Gone Bad album. Back then, I used to wonder whether or not Rihanna needed to be deported. Fret not, for I have thoroughly repented for my sins since then. I used to think the idea of meeting someone from the internet was a foolproof way of having your mother awakened in the middle of the night by a call confirming your untimely slaughter. However, you just can't ignore the kind of bond you strike with a person over your shared devotion to Beyonce. Shawnee had wanted to meet me as soon as she found out we were now living in the same city. I kept making excuses for why we couldn't get together. I was far too afraid. Not of her stabbing me to death with a plastic fork from Church's Chicken. Their forks were especially pointy, or anything like that. I didn't want to meet any new people at this point in time. That would have likely resulted in most people's first impressions of me being that I was the worst sort of LA transient cliche. Broken, immobile. I arrived in Los Angeles with only one freelance job that paid $1,500 a month. I also had the nerve to show up in LA without a car. Going to Los Angeles without a car is like going into a steakhouse without any teeth and without a dentist connect. Only even more nerve-wracking. Fortunately, soon after my arrival, two additional writing gigs presented themselves, and I started saving for a car. In the meantime, I rode the bus. If you want to learn how to give up on humanity, ride the bus in LA. The only other entity that makes me want to immediately abandon hope in mankind is a public restroom, where you quickly learn how few people wash their damn hands. On top of the bus being crammed full of people who needed to better familiarize themselves with manners and strong deodorant, it was also a wonderfully shitty way to get around the city. Whenever I recall the days of riding the bus in LA, folks quickly hit me back, what about Uber, Lyft? I moved to Los Angeles on the day Barack Hussein Obama was sworn in as president. Literally every other Negro flying that day was heading to D.C., while I was moving to Los Angeles to watch the inauguration on TV. This was 2009. There was no such thing as Uber. You had your feet and you had the bus or the subway that no LA native seemed to know existed. So yeah, I was reluctant to tell someone I hadn't met before. As much as I'd love to hang out tonight, I don't know how to get to the suggested location by bus, and by the time we're done, I'll need a cab ride I can't afford. These sorts of musings were appreciated only on the East Coast. Months later, around my birthday, I finally admitted to Shawnee that I had no car and thus no big birthday plans. Actually, no birthday plans at all. Ever kind and sweetly relentless, she offered to pick me up on my birthday and take me to the Improv for a show. She was super cute, long hair that looked to be from the finest scalps found in New Delhi, Oh, and the boobs. She had really huge, round boobs. Close your eyes and take that all in if such a type is your thing. When she arrived, she had a six-pack of cupcakes from Crumbs in tow. Not many people were willing to spend $24 on a person they were meeting face-to-face for the first time. Shawnee told me that night she had been reading my blog, The Cynical Ones, back when it was nothing more than random rants posted on MySpace. She said all the nice things a writer with a dream wanted to hear, that I was funny, special, and that she could see me going very far in my career. She couldn't see a damn thing at night because she was halfway blonde, but she saw me being successful in the future and eating red velvet in the moment. Cupcakes and compliments produced the friendship. It was one that teetered on being one-sided, at least when it came to the bill. I was grateful but really uneasy with Shawnee's generosity. She would insist on paying, and I would feel guilty for allowing it. I wasn't good with accepting generosity. I wasn't proud of that, but I was raised not to expect anything from anyone outside of immediate family members, and I wasn't even asking them for anything. My guilt translated into declined invitations to continue hanging out. Several declines, actually. I just knew that if I didn't have the money, or had it but needed to save it, it was best to keep myself in that small room. Shawnee was only being nice, of course, but I continued to feel as if I were an undeserving charity case. What also got to me was the realization that I needed to return the favor and treat her. She was into those restaurants where celebrities, or quasi-celebrities, would call paparazzi to purposely show up and photograph them so they could end up on TMZ, blogs, and social media. In their minds, this made them seem important. I found it to be like taking the taint of desperation and rubbing it all over your face. I got that it was some folks' business model, but it was stupid all the same. Somewhere, though, some paparazzo person is like, but you be looking, though. In any event, knowing my audience, I invited her to dinner at one of those spiffy restaurants people in L.A. like to harp about eating at. Shawnee accepted, but naturally still had to pick me up because it would be a few more months before I finally had my own ride. We went to Crustacean, a European-Vietnamese restaurant in Beverly Hills that boasted about being the place to walk on water. They mean walk over a fountain. I suppose if Jesus didn't trademark the phrase, it's legally available for others to use. But I don't blame him if he saw that, flipped his bang, and laughed. The restaurant was hailed for its garlic noodles. I never liked the cheaper, heart attack-inducing ramen noodles that came in a package, so I was even less interested in trying this wealthier, highfalutin cousin. As Shawnee sat there browsing the menu while I contemplated accidentally falling on purpose in order to get a free meal, a loud and very large man in a Fila tracksuit approached our table as if we had motioned him over. Mr. Fila tracksuit asked Shawnee, "Are y'all from L.A.?" There's a reason why parents tell their kids don't talk to strangers, but unfortunately, Shawnee loved talking to strangers and would do so whenever the opportunity presented itself. No matter where we were, if someone said the weather was nice, it was always nice in L.A., even when it rained, it was still nicer than rain elsewhere. She managed to end up talking to the person about how their high school quarterback had stage 4 colon cancer and how the entire class was grief-stricken. I used to be that way too. Back in high school, two of my close friends, Kim and Shalisa, joked about how I would have full-on conversation with folks I had just met. There was a difference though. Strangers talked to me, but even though I had a slick mouth on me, I was Southern and thus polite. Shawnee revealed her native status while I made clear that I was from Houston. Literally a second later, Mr. Fila asked me if I knew someone named Brad Ford. I said no, and Fila screamed, "You from Houston and you don't know Brad Ford? What, you a medical student or something?" I had no idea what one had to do with the other. I informed Fila that I was actually a writer. He immediately decided to grab a chair and sit down. Who had told him to sit down? Not me. Why hadn't I just said I was an unemployed chronic masturbator instead? Telling someone in Los Angeles that you're a writer can yield a number of results. The first might easily be skepticism. Social media has made it easier than ever for people to present what is arguably still a hobby as their profession. Those people who post shots of their butt cheeks on Snapchat or Instagram, run through a few filters and caption with a camera emoji and some person's name? Yeah, meet Jordan Dunn and Annie Leibovitz. And there are so many stylists out there who literally have one client, themselves. Granted, a writer is anyone who writes. The same goes for anyone else who's starting with a dream and pushing to make it their main source of income. I respect and support you. That aside, I write for a living. And even now, when I tell people I'm a writer, I'm sometimes met with a pushback along the lines of, "Sure, but how do you eat?" Another response could be one of pity because, well, who wants to be a writer in an era where people can't even be burdened to type out happy birthday in full on social media anymore? Then there's curiosity. Who do you write for? What sort of writing do you do? You must choose your answers wisely in order to avoid the moment when the person starts wondering to themselves, what can that person do for me? Suddenly, I felt that a red dart was being aimed at my forehead. Fila seemed to possess a large amount of self-esteem. It was evident in the fact that he spent 20 minutes talking about his life to a couple of strangers who showed not a lick of genuine interest in what he had to say. It was my own fault for remembering the rule about respecting my elders. That was dumb because fuck this rude old man. I was also wrong for making a sincere effort to try to control my ever-expressive face. Nature determined me to be the type of person who looked at you stupid the second you displayed such behavior. I had tried to go against the natural order, and Fila was my punishment. After a while, I started to tune him out. Not completely, of course. I needed to know just what level of crazy I was dealing with. As he kept rambling, he pulled out two IDs from his wallet. One had an address that Shani later explained to me was located in some part of LA far worse than where I was. The other ID had some address in Beverly Hills. Why was he telling us any of this? To this day, I'm still waiting on Scooby-Doo and the Mystery Machine to email their findings. Fila went on and on. He was a motor mouth with a fresh tune-up. He talked about how rich he was, how he had a house in Manhattan, how he had first arrived in L.A. on a Greyhound bus with 20 cents in his pocket, how he could walk into what he described as this fine establishment in a Fila tracksuit. If only the 1990s had kept this man in the decade he belonged in. In between all of his ranting, he repeatedly asked me if I wanted to make money, mumbling something about 35% in Paramount. Initially, I assumed that if I let this crazy motherfucker talk to me for a few minutes, he would eventually go away. But then several minutes went by. Maybe it was only 7 minutes, but it felt like forever. Squared. After a while, I started to realize that this Fila tracksuit-wearing fucker smelled like cool cigarettes and more than likely had spent the previous 2 hours of the night tongue-kissing a bottle of Crown Royal. Probably the maple version, because he was nasty and constantly thought of bacon. When he had first sat down, I had gotten the sense that he assumed I was dating Shani. I must have spoken or gestured in a more detectable way, because all of a sudden, Fila stopped mid-sentence and asked me, "Are you a homosexual?" "Yes, as long as women still come with vaginas." "Does my straightness make you uncomfortable?" Well, this was different. Usually it was the other way around, the straight person professing his discomfort at a gay person. Was I supposed to be flattered by this line of questioning? But the answer to his question was no. His straightness wasn't the irritant. His existence itself was. This is the part of the one-sided discussion when I pulled my glass of water closer to me. Fila quipped, "Oh man, I'm talking over your water. From the bottom of my heart, I am so sorry." A simple "my bad" would have sufficed, but in any case, that wasn't why I had pulled the glass closer to me. Sensing an attitude at this point, I started to wonder if this crazy-ass man was going to swing on me. I needed to be prepared just in case he tried it. I might have to bash that glass in his face and start swinging. It finally hit me that Fila wasn't going to leave the table of his own accord. I was being way too polite, which allowed him to get way too comfortable. I was shocked he didn't order an appetizer before we did. Then again, he didn't have a chance to. Our waitress had left us alone for quite some time. When she finally did come back, he told her, "Nah, they're not ready to order." "Man, fuck this." "Yes, we are. Homie, hold on." I motioned to the waitress to come back over while beginning to grip that glass of water more firmly. Finally, we were able to order our meals. Siditi salmon, bougie crab legs, and those damn noodles everyone was fawning over. "It's time for you to go, sir." "Sir?" Another problem. Southern manners. Being civilized clearly wasn't going to work. Also not working was Fila repeatedly touching my arm while he spoke to me. I guess my gayness didn't bother his straightness. After finishing his soliloquy about why his life ought to be made into a movie, Fila kept pressing me. "Now what do you say? Do you want to make money?" "I'm okay. Good luck to you and your book deal movie thing." Follow with, "No disrespect, man, but you've been here for a minute, and I'm with my friend, and we're trying to enjoy our dinner." "Well, fine, die poor." "Say what?" I have been banished into poverty over declining the offer to write this unidentified man's autobiography and biopic. You try to help people out, and look how they treat you. Fine, be poor, die poor, your problem. Coincidentally, I was being told this as I was developing the fear of such a fate. Los Angeles was the perfect place to let this sort of anxiety blossom, giving everyone's penchant to parade their wealth. Even the theme of this dinner was my modest way of showing appreciation for kindness and generosity to someone in a much better position than mine. Offended by the writing guy from Houston who had the nerve to not know who the unidentified but seemingly awesome Brad Ford was, Fila huffed and puffed and finally got his ass the hell away from our table. Our waitress came back with our food. Sensing the hostility in the air, it dawned on her what had just happened. Wait, did you know that guy? No, you damn fool. I thought he was your father the way he was yelling at you. Now, my looks have been described as a fake-ass Chris Brown and a knockoff Chico DeBarge. By contrast, Fila looked like what if Danny Glover lived on an all-pork and cigarette diet. Like father, like son? The manager appeared and Fila, still lingering around the premises, likely searching for another black victim in the restaurant, was escorted out. The manager apologized and offered us a free dessert. The dessert was bland as hell. Considering they let a stranger in nylon terrorize me at the table, they could have at least offered us some liquor. Hell, I would have settled for complimentary crab cakes. A southern restaurant sure would have given us some, and maybe even suggested we drive to the Walmart after and get us a gun and some of those frozen Tyson chicken tenders on sale. In the midst of Fila's fury, Shawnee and I didn't pick up on the live entertainment at the restaurant. I'm not sure if this was to our benefit, but the jazz vocalist and pianist, both white, started performing a spirited rendition of Wade in the Water. Wade in the water, Wade in the water, children. Wade in the water, God's gonna trouble the water. Yes, white people in an Asian fusion restaurant were performing a Negro spiritual. If any Negro spirits had been awakened by their performance, it would have likely been only to bitch slap them both in disgust. When the bill came, the dinner totaled $120 plus tip. As Shawnee reached for her wallet, I reminded her that this was my treat. Are you sure? Yes, I said hastily. A crazy man, forecast of poverty, and a poorly advised song selection combined with food that wasn't remarkably special notwithstanding, I had promised to pay for this dinner, and I intended to keep my word. This meal encapsulated my entire outlook on Los Angeles, a pretty place full of kind natives largely overshadowed by soulless transients looking to score. I have no idea what happened to that old man, but I hope that Fila tracksuit of his caught on fire. Learning how to hoe and date and failing at both. Having paranoia about sex did not mean that I lived a completely asexual experience. For me, there was the ideal situation in which I desired to have sex in terms of penetration, someone I cared about deeply, and the reality that during immense fits of sexual frustration, I needed a release. Sometimes this meant engaging in sexual acts that assuaged some of that unsettling tension, but left me feeling as though I was too loose with my own standards. Most times, however, I went on dates with the intent to forge meaningful connections that would give way to the ideal scenarios for sexual eruptions. Unfortunately, I forgot to keep one thing in mind. Men are fucking awful. 1. 2007. I assumed he was biracial, because despite clearly being of Asian descent, he had braids and wore a grill, and his name was Chavante. He didn't necessarily have Jackson 5 nostrils, but they were at least B2K nostrils, so there was a legit reason not to have a definitive answer on his racial makeup. And again, his name was Chavante. Not to be completely stereotypical, but Chavante is the kind of name that screams black. For the record, I'm not a racist working in human resources who sees a name like Chavante and promptly deletes the resume over fears that upon being hired, he'll show up carrying a huge tub of Lari seasoned salt and sprinkle it all around his cubicle to mark his territory as he quietly plans the race war on company time. In fact, I've mulled naming a set of twins I'll create with the help of science, Destiny's Child and Jodeci. Then again, there are quite a few 1990s babies with the name Jodeci, and perhaps I ought to go with another R&B group of that era like Troop or Silk. I remain undecided on that, but to be clear, while I have no problems with names that scream black, 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 I do expect someone named Chavante to at least have 1% of Negro descent. We met at a gay black club in Houston called 2020. It was Saturday night, so virtually every gay black man who was a club goer would frequent it. yet another reason to assume Trevante was a racial and ethnic concoction like Tiger Woods. I was back in Houston, miserable and trying to figure out how in the hell I had ended up back in my hometown after spending all the time and money in college trying to live anywhere else but Houston. Going to the club and getting drunk out of my mind was a coping mechanism. I also went because my sex life was non-existent, and that club was a good venue for me to work out some of my sexual frustration. I wasn't having sex, but I did fill up on boys, get felt up myself, and on occasion, exchange numbers with someone who ideally might become someone I would get to know, fall for, and, when I felt comfortable, consummate the relationship with. I had been at 20, 24 hours, and it was nearing the time for me to begin drinking a whole lot of water, chill for a spell in the parking lot of the club with the other gays who didn't know when to go home, and make a pit stop at Whataburger before going back home and purposely forgetting everything that just happened. The club was massive. It had three levels, the only two functioned as places where everyone actually partied. The line began on the ground floor, but you had to walk up steps to have your ID checked and pay to get in. Upon entry, you were on the second level, which was a sizable space in of itself, but there were two ramps on both the left and right sides that took you down to the massive dance floor. And there was a very large stage area where men would occasionally perform. Either they would perform as drag queens or set up their own impromptu dance troupe and twerk it out while everyone was drunk or high out of their minds. Trevante was sitting in the middle of that stage surrounded by a sea of black boys. He made eye contact with me, possibly because he thought I might have been my brother, but that was about it. I was used to men not approaching me and having to make the first move, so I walked over. I introduced myself. I told him that he was cute, and we exchanged numbers. Upon texting, I learned that he was not mixed but Filipino. I should have known better. This was Houston, Texas, where braids and grills were as common as men in the hood going up and down the street on horseback. Houston has and always been incredibly diverse, but there is a bit of what some would describe as ratchetness to be found in city residents regardless of their socioeconomic status or racial background. Whether or not they have any inherent anti-blackness may be another story, though. I was complimentary and flirtatious, but I often had a habit of sometimes speaking a wee bit too loosely. When I found out he was Filipino rather than being the byproduct of at least one black parent, I said, "Oh, you're like an Asian Paul Wall." Paul Wall was a white rapper from Houston who had immersed himself in the culture well enough to where he could bring potato salad to a cookout and black folks present wouldn't inherently question whether he put raisins in it. He had a black wife, so she'd likely step in and save the day. One could only discern the tone of texting to a certain point, but I got the sense Trevante didn't love the comparison, despite my actually having spotted him sing along to Paul Wall in the club that same night. He let it slide, though, because after a few more days of texting back and forth, we finally set up a date. He told me to meet him at a sushi spot I understood to be frequented by all kinds, but on Fridays was populated heavily by black people. It had a lengthy happy hour that went well into the night, with heavily discounted food and drinks. It also had a large area for dining and an equally big area that served as more of a lounge. Guess which night Trevante picked? He did so partially because he had a relative there who worked as a bartender, one who would be quite generous with his gig's available alcohol. Considering that I only recently started freelance writing and was learning to save money to move away, in addition to developing the skill set to efficiently harass accounts payable departments to get my money in a timely manner, I was not going to turn down a date with a cute boy who had lots of muscles and tats, with free drinks to boot. After all, my broke ass was driving my mama's car there anyway. We met at the bar, and as soon as I sat down, he asked me if I wanted something to eat. I told him no. I had not eaten all day. I had a high tolerance when it came to drinking, but that was only if you factored in food first. Given that I had nothing in my stomach before I was due to drink a lot with this guy, my answer should have been an emphatic yes. But no, not me. I wanted to be cute and drink. For a while, we simply talked. I learned that he was a junior at the University of Houston, majoring in criminal justice with the goal of going to law school and becoming a lawyer. I told him about my time at Howard, what I had done, and what I still planned to do once I escaped again. Then he asked if I wanted to take a shot. I said sure, so we took a shot, and then another, and then another, and then another. Suddenly, it had become some sort of competition. In between the shots, we ordered more drinks. I lost count of how many we took, but I do know in between those shots, my body turned into a placeholder for his hands, and I responded in kind. He asked me if I had any plans afterwards, and upon my saying no, he suggested we link up with his cousin and the guy she was with and all hang out. I agreed, but after tipping his brother and standing up, it dawned on me just how drunk I was. Keeping in line with a night of questionable choices, rather than take the elevator down to the car, I went down the steps, petrified of falling down and knocking out my two big buck front teeth. Although Trevante had driven himself, he noticed how drunk I was and said I could leave my car there and he would drive me as we all hung out for a few more hours. By then, I would sober up, he would take me back to my car, and we would go on our merry ways. He didn't seem drunk at all. That was probably because he had eaten food, drunk a lot of water, and behaved like an adult who wanted to have his cognitive functions working. I handed him the keys but told him to wait a second. I needed to pee. I didn't go back into the restaurant, which was only a few feet away. No, I whipped my dick out in front of a closed Victoria's Secret and pissed directly in front of it. Highland Village featured an upscale shopping center down the street from the Galleria, another upscale shopping center in Houston that was home to many fancy restaurants and a grocery store I would aptly describe as the nice rich white folks' grocery store to get meat from. And I was pissing outside in front of the store where you buy nice panties and body lotions. As Trevante was driving me to wherever we were going, he made a pit stop at a gas station. He told me that I needed to get some air, so I did. I sat outside on the curb for a few minutes and called one of my friends as he went inside to buy whatever. Unbeknownst to my drunk ass, I was sitting on a fire ant bed. For several minutes, it didn't hit me that I was being eaten alive by an army of ants until I started to feel them at the tippy top of my back as they raced to get to my neck and finish me off. I leaped up in agony and started to scream, "What the fuck?" It was Trevante who noticed the ants and told me to take off my shirt. In gentlemanly fashion, he took off his shirt and then took off his undershirt and started to try to knock them off of me with it. I wasn't certain that we got them all off, but I didn't feel like I was a buffet offering anymore, so we got back into the car and ended up at some sort of motel. I wasn't anticipating that we'd have sex on date number one. Sure, we did have chemistry and I was perpetually horny, but we hadn't discussed that. Yet I was drunk and needed to spend a few hours sobering up. I had no idea whose room this was or what part of town I was in. As soon as I got there, I immediately got in the shower to wash off whatever ants might have still been on my body. Trevante quickly joined me. He didn't have a single ounce of body fat on him, whereas I was worried about whether or not I had done enough push-ups to make certain that I didn't have man boobs. After the shower, we got into bed. Moments later, his cousin and some black man with locks joined us. They were on one bed and we were on the other. Was I at the intersection of a family reunion and a sex party? Yet, despite the setting being primed for drunken sex, we did not have it. Between the shower and the water I started downing in the car and continued drinking in this spot, things were becoming clearer. So, did we roll around a while? Yes, but we didn't have any form of sex. He tried to slide himself into my mouth, but I had already put too many things down my throat that night, so I was tapped out. I let him finish on me as a compromise. It was the least I could do. By the time I looked around, I noticed that Trevante's cousin and her black man were both gone. I put my clothes back on, grabbed my car keys, and left. Once I got home, my mom was already getting ready for her 6 a.m. shift at the hospital. It was a good thing she was, because the pain that came from all those ant bumps across my stomach and my back was surfacing, and it was excruciating. My mom looked at me in shock and horror, wondering how this could have happened. I left off the drunk part of the explanation. Regardless, Eva the nurse, my mom pulled out some creams and other medication and told me what to do. While the pain went away, the scarring from all that scratching I was told not to do was setting in. If not for the power of cocoa butter, who knows what would have become of my stomach. As for Trevante, we never had a second date. We texted each other about having had a good time, but it quickly fizzled out. That was probably for the best. I would leave for Los Angeles in the coming months. But more importantly, on a first date with him, I had gotten too drunk to drive, peed on a fancy panty store, sat on an ant bed, and then let him bust on me. And in hindsight, it was likely that Trevante wasn't his damn name and I was being fetishized. The thought had crossed my mind at one point because he did try to use nigga near the end, and I immediately said, "Oh, we're not doing that." I had scars for months across my abdomen. Bless my heart. 2. 2007. Months after Trevante, the dark scars across my stomach began to fade, and I met Michael, who worked at one of the nicer grocery chains in Houston. They were nicer because they were all primarily located in white neighborhoods. I lived in a black neighborhood, and directly behind my neighborhood was another neighborhood largely populated by Latinos. The grocery stores nearest both our hoods at the time were fine, but one could easily gauge who was blessed and highly favored when it came to food. We shopped at all of them, but more often than not, my mom would pick up meat from the nicer stores. Unless she fried catfish and shrimp, and we went to the store near us that had live seafood, like the real ones they are. She never directly made mention of it, but one thing I learned from her shopping habits was that simply living in an area considered to be inner city did not mean we had to be eating food of lower quality. As I got older, I noticed the price points between the grocery stores weren't all that different. What was different, however, was the quality of meat. The meat at the grocery stores in white neighborhoods was better than the meat found in the black ones. Once I bought ground turkey at one of the black ones and was keeled over in pain for 3 days, so I tried to shop there instead. The grocery store Michael worked at was about a 15-minute drive, very little driving time by Houston standards, so if the difference was between meat I could trust and the meat that could have me dying decades before I intended to, I went with the former. Judgmental folks have scrunched up their faces when I say this, but I have found grocery shopping to be relaxing because it provides me with the perfect opportunity to turn on my headphones and twerk down the aisles while looking for discounted tortilla chips. The kind that either say blue corn or multigrain, so you'll have less guilt about inhaling the entire bag while watching The Real Housewives of Atlanta, because you've convinced yourself that because the chips aren't fried, they're healthier for you. When I go to the grocery store, I normally zone out, bop aggressively, and rummage through the chicken to find the perfect package of wings. Bountiful, but not so pricey that you end up saying, fuck this, I'ma get Popeyes because it's the same price with less work. Shit. The grocery store, much like the gym, constituted me time. I was back in Houston and feeling defeated. And when I wasn't working and plotting to move the hell away all over again during most weekdays, I downed way too much caffeine, hit the gym, and followed that with a trip to the grocery store. I noticed Michael a few times before we spoke to each other, but I hadn't pursued him. He looked young. Not young to the point that if I spoke to him, an undercover police officer would jump out of the meat freezer and tackle me, but still. Alas, while I was stripper kicking in the chip aisle, he asked me if I needed anything. Despite being sweaty as hell and a bit perturbed that he had interrupted me during my favorite part of Crime Mob's Rock Your Hips, I thanked him for offering to help, but noted that I was fine. He apologized for bothering me, though after noticing his name tag, I told him that my name was Michael too. The Michael that wasn't me smiled about that, but considering this Michael hated small talk, I told him to have a good night and went about my way. I turned around, and sure enough, he was still looking at me. I left the grocery store without the chips and went to Taco Cabana, located in the same parking lot as that grocery store, and proceeded to blow my workout. Once you meet someone, you tend to keep running into them, especially if, you know, they work there and shit. I ran into Michael multiple times over the next month. I would speak to him, but I kept the conversation at minimum. Gradually, the length of our conversations extended, and we started to learn a few things about each other. He had just finished high school and was planning to go to college in Louisiana. I told him that I had just finished college. I wasn't sure what prompted it, a hand motion or some other mannerism from me, but he felt compelled to randomly note that he liked women. Oh, cool, that's nice. Translation, I don't want you, dude. Calm your dick and delusions of grandeur. Was he cute? Yes. Is that why I talked to him when I spotted him in the grocery store? I considered it a bonus, as an aesthetic treat as part of my karma for being a polite Southern man. Did I go to the grocery store sometimes hoping to run into him? Only once, so it shouldn't be held against me. Shut up. Regardless, as nice as he was to look at, I didn't care that much about him. If I had never seen him again after that evening, I would have been perfectly fine. I hate when seemingly straight men do that. Not every gay man is concerned about you. We often do not care and can be just as tribal as the breeders. So I didn't need the disclaimer that he had a girlfriend because I wasn't in the grocery aisle cruising. As fate would have it, it turned out that he did have some nominal sexual interest in men that he had not yet explored. This was confirmed the next time I saw him at the grocery store when he found me and asked for my number. My immediate response was that I was a little old for him. He was 18, about to turn 19. I asked for his ID because you will not catch the kid slipping. And I was a smooth 23 years old by then. That wasn't a big gap in actuality, but it was in mindset. I had already finished college, and he was about to start at some school in Louisiana playing basketball. No matter my age, since coming out, I'd noticed that I tended to attract younger men. Part of that was people tending to assume I was younger than I actually was, The other and more indicting part of this pattern was that my apparent youthfulness could also register as sexual immaturity. Or maybe because I was older, he assumed I was more experienced and could help him figure his own self out. Whatever the case, I didn't think we'd have much to talk about. But this didn't matter, since conversation wasn't at the center of either of our interests. After texting for a few days, he told me that he was getting off work soon and asked if I wanted to link up. His car was in the shop, so I picked him up from work and we hung out. He didn't live that far from the store, so he suggested we drive around a bit before making a stop in some park. After parking, we took off our seatbelts and engaged in no more than 2 minutes of empty conversation before he reached for my dick. Once he finished, he asked me to return the favor. Now, there are some people in this world who love sucking dick. I am not one of them. That's not to say I can't perform well, because someone fine as hell could be reading this when duty calls, but I can be selfish as shit when it comes to blowing other men. Most dicks are ugly. Therefore, I reserve going down for people I sincerely care about, or if you're really, really fond, and that spurs my generous spirit. This was not the case for Michael, whom I did not know and who had already proven to be a bit of a liar. He made the most pitiful face in the world, and I guess since my dick was the first one he had ever had in his mouth, I begrudgingly returned the favor. Damn, my girl don't even do it like this. Yo, who, nigga? Why was I not surprised that he had a girlfriend? I didn't know the young lady, of course, but apparently she didn't give good head, and I imagine she didn't touch his ass in a way that prompted further internal inquiries about his primary sexual attraction. The tryst ended abruptly as some police officer drove into the parking lot, presumably to check out why some random car was there that late at night. Not trying to pay tribute to George Michael's arrest record, I told Michael to zip up and then took him home. He texted me that he had had a good time and that we should link again soon. The next morning, I woke up and saw various scrapes across my dick. The little bastard had braces. Was this karma for the scrapes I had left on Jordan years before? I took myself to CVS to get some triple antibiotic ointment. There was no next time. Funny, after those months of always seeing him at his job after leaving the gym, I ran into him one Saturday morning at the gym. He was with some older man, and while I knew better than to run up on him like, "So we gonna fuck next time or no?" I did at least try to say hello. I couldn't even reach the O in hello because younger Michael sprinted like hell away from me. If he hadn't gotten his cardio in before that, he for sure got it racing away from me. I texted to ask if there was a problem. Radio silence. I tried to text him a few days after that. Again, no response. Then it hit me. Oh, this dude truly is conflicted. That fear in his eyes looked familiar. He enjoyed me, but he wasn't ready to face what that meant. At the time, I thought it was my fault. That once again, I had repelled some man. But that was not the pattern to be concerned with. The pattern that required my real attention was my turning to sexually confused men for sexual exploration. It was like turning my attention to someone who can't figure out the difference between there, and there to edit your essay. I would have had sex with Michael if the opportunity had presented itself, but it didn't because he was afraid. His fear of me made me more fearful about my own sexual exploration. God, what if he had hit a vein with that metal contraption wired to his mouth? Could I have bled to death? Can you imagine my funeral? We lost our wannabe whorish but nonetheless Christian brother Michael Joseph Arsenault to an adulterous act performed by a curious sodomite. I don't know if he went to hell, but let us pray that God had more mercy on Michael's soul than that other Michael had on his penis. Several years later, I saw Michael at a gay bar called Bayou City. I was home for the holidays, and while I love my straight cousins, I wanted the company of other sissies dancing to music I could only hear at a club back home. Michael looked older and, to me, much better. He didn't notice me until a little later. I was leaving the bathroom and going back to the bar because more brown liquor felt necessary. Then our eyes met. He didn't look afraid anymore, and from the looks of it, had a boyfriend with him. All we did was give each other a nod as a greeting. As much as I had resented watching someone literally run away from the sight of me, I understood it. With age came experience. Speaking of, now that he was free of braces, no funeral would have to be planned. 3, 2010. We met outside the Abbey. It was 2 a.m., so Los Angeles had effectively shut down because the city's nightlife was useless without alcohol, unless you had weed and access to an after-hours spot worth your time. That night I was in possession of neither, so it was time to drive my ass to Jack in the Box, devour a bacon ultimate cheeseburger value meal with curly fries and a Coke, each jumbo size, shower, and take my ass to sleep. As I was walking out, I locked eyes with a guy whom, a few hours prior, I had seen while in the midst of complaining to my friends for the upteenth time that I missed the gay bars in the South because techno music made me question the existence of God. He was incredibly attractive. If I were an A&R exec, I would sell him as a man who had the appearance of a heartthrob R&B singer, but lacked the talent to be one. We could sell him to audiences as a semi-competent rapper who could get girls and gays to monetarily support his musical career for a few years. A light-skinned version of Chingy, if you will. His name was Antoine. I'm not for sure why the name needed to be separated with that apostrophe, but I don't want to disrespect that man's mama, so I'll leave it alone. He went by that name, his middle name, and a hyphenated last name that consisted of both his parents' last names. I applaud the progressiveness there, but one of his parents had a last name as long as the space between New York and Los Angeles. I bet he took all day to sign shit. He was waiting outside with his friends when we made eye contact for a second time, but as always, it was up to me to do the approaching. So I did, and although he was warm to me, you got the sense that he could be cold to those he didn't want in his periphery. My concerns were heightened once we started to communicate via text. It was a strong whiff of jackass emanating from his messages. The same can be said of the clear signs of stupid. I am no grammar Nazi. I don't anticipate anyone writing in complete sentences. I accept people using the letter U for you, or the letters U R for your, and whatever instances of shorthand folks like to use sans the following. HBU, WYD, and HBD. With him, it wasn't so much how he typed, but what he said, or was trying to say. You could tell he was more into the superficial than the substantive. It was all too apparent he was more invested in optics than anything else. It was as if his texts were trying to reach through the screen to warn me, don't do this, Arsenal. And yet, I asked him out anyway, because he was incredibly attractive, and I wanted some ass. So I went, despite having it on good ground that this probably wouldn't work the way I thought it would. Where we chose to eat was a bit of a one-sided negotiation. He was adamant about picking the restaurant, and every single one of his options was ultra-expensive. I didn't mind paying for an expensive meal, nor did I object to paying for the company of someone I had invited out. Did I have it like that? Hell no, but you weren't going to have me out looking like I was a cheap ass. Still, the way he broached the issue was a turnoff. He discussed it with this sense of entitlement coupled with the bitchiness that I found frustrating. Like, I don't mind taking you where you want to go, but you're acting like an escort, and if that's the case, how much are you? We can get to the point, because, after all, food would get in the way, no? Having said that, despite getting the sense that he wasn't the sharpest person in the Southern California region from his texts, most of those texts were flirtatious on both ends, so once again, I brushed the signs away. Antoine ended up picking none of the options he had previously mentioned. Maybe he merely wanted to see if I would be willing to go wherever he wanted. Whatever the case, we ended up at Yard House, some sedity sports bar. I went with an open mind and hoped for the best. That feeling didn't last long. Once we sat in front of each other, the sense that I had that he had the capability to be cold was promptly confirmed. He greeted me like I was the uncle who falsely claimed one of his mama's children to cheat on his taxes. During the get-to-know-each-other portion of the evening, he said, "Wait. You said you were a writer, right? What do you write about?" After giving him the topics and some of the outlets I was writing for, he looked at me up and down and snarled, "I don't like to read." My response should have been, "You don't like to read, but you write lengthy-ass Facebook posts as if you're Ayanna Van Zant with a learning disability or a keyboard that barely functions because you spilled a liter of Dr. Pepper on it." Who doesn't like to read? This beautiful, empty-headed jackass who liked to dispense passionate, grossly uninformed life tips on the Mark Zuckerberg-made platform, apparently. Yes, it was a pretty shitty thing to respond to a writer by saying, "I don't like to read," but at the same time, I didn't give that great of a fuck. If you wanted to be stupid, such was your right. What insulted me was what happened a few minutes later. My back was turned to the person when he said it, but Antoine declared, "You look just like that dude at the bar." I turned around and looked. It's impolite to call someone ugly, but it's equally rude to tell a person that they resemble someone you would call a booger wolf in your head. "I don't look like him." "Yeah, you do." "I don't look like him, Antoine. Come on, you've got to see it." I don't see shit over there but someone's child who doesn't at all look like the one in front of you. But he kept pressing it. It's one thing to say you think my profession is a waste of time because the consumption of words is too taxing an ordeal for you and your unimaginative mind, but I'll be damned if you say I mirror a man who appears to be well over a decade older, at least 20 pounds smaller, and it looks like the light inside of him got stomped out by 3 cases of bourbon consumed 5 years prior. You got me fucked up. In just under an hour, I had learned Antoine was blind and dumb. Thankfully, he spared me from discovering that he might also be slightly deaf, because he said he had somewhere to be in the morning. He meant his job, but I personally wish that he would drive into the fourth circle of hell. We didn't hug goodbye, and that was perfectly fine. While in the parking lot, I started to entertain the thought of finding a hypnotist to fulfill my mom's desire for me to like vagina, marry one, and make grandchildren with it in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, because that motherfucker annoyed the everlasting shit out of me. By the time I got inside of my car, I called my friend Kim in Houston. I asked her if it would be okay to run him over. She told me no. I know violence is wrong, and I already look like Chris Brown's second cousin to some people, but doesn't he deserve to be hit? Yes, but you can't do that. I don't got no bail money. Considering how often God behaved like a troll, it was no surprise that I ran into Antoine repeatedly for a few months, and then finally he fizzled away. 2 years later, I got a message from him on Facebook Messenger. It was 6 a.m. in New York, where I now live, which meant it was the middle of the night for him back in L.A. H-U-B. The fuck is that? Oh, you want to know how I've been. This is why you need to join a book club, damn fool. After that, he randomly inserted that he was horny. It was the fringes of the day, so I was too. We took the conversation back to text after he sent a picture revealing just how horny he was. I responded by saying I wish I had gotten the chance to get at that when I was in L.A. Me too, but you was tripping. By my love of literacy? Supposedly, I was too eager and rushing him to get serious. Serious how? I had no idea what he was talking about and could bet he was confusing me with some other sucker whose time he had also wasted. After masturbating to his videos and pictures, I was finished and told him if he was ever in New York, he could hit me up and we could finally make something happen. He said cool while casually mentioning that I could also fly him to New York. Hardy hard, bitch. My mistake was that I should have never bothered trying to get to know him on any deeper level. This wasn't how you were supposed to hoe. You made your attentions clear and acted accordingly. I knew this fool was a fool only good for fornication, and I gave far too much energy to someone I could only deal with in scenarios centered on ejaculation. He was a terrible person. Having said that, I know terrible people can be tempting, and despite his being an insulting, rude simpleton who needs to have his eyes examined, I was still fucked. Obviously, it would be a hate fuck. And for my own comfort, I would bring a book and pull a condom out of it. 4, 2016. Even after he told me that once upon a time, he'd faced nearly a 25-year sentence for beating the hell out of his ex to the point he had multiple severe head wounds, I was thinking I still fucked though. We met at a restaurant called Sexy Taco Dirty Cash in Harlem. Sexy Taco Dirty Cash sounds like the name of a rapper's mixtape. I know this because the name of my unreleased mixtape is Cognac and Celexa. Before the restaurant was called Sexy Taco Dirty Cash, it was called La Bodega. And before it was called La Bodega, it was called Native. These name changes all happened within the first 4 years of my living in Harlem. In spite of this, the owner has remained the same. Presumably, he bores easily, and change is a constant in his sphere. Sexy Taco Dirty Cash is a rum bar that sells tacos inspired by San Francisco food trucks. That is their description, not mine. I am from Texas, and after living in Los Angeles for a few years, I now know that Tex-Mex is nothing like Mexican food found in any other region of the country. Like most Texans, I think our way is the best way. Bryce, the man who almost went to prison for manslaughter, was also from Texas, so we shared this sentiment about Mexican food and most things generally. He wasn't from the best part, Houston, like me and Beyonce, but I didn't hold that against him either. People always talk about forgiveness, but we do not always allow people who aren't necessarily monsters, but committed monstrous acts, the space to sincerely start over. Bryce talked a lot about therapy, anger management, moving to New York, and pointingly, the ability to know when to leave a violent relationship. He came across as sincere in changing the course of his life after his self-described life-changing experience. Bryce also had a Louisiana connection. He was, as one country-ass man who read my name at a Midwestern airport once blurted out, "One of them Creoles, ain't you?" Bryce worked as a hairstylist, primarily taming heads over at the de facto state network TV known as Fox News. When he shared this, I had to make a conscious decision to ask more questions and potentially sour the mood of this drink situation, or just sit and smile and try to get to know the hottie in front of me. It had taken a good while for this meeting to happen. I had been talking to Bryce online for well over a month and had decidedly given up on us linking because he didn't seem that interested in me. Then out of the blue on Facebook, he circled back to an invitation beginning to mold in the dark corner of his messenger inbox to ask, "Are we ever going to get those drinks?" I assumed he was bored, but considering I was being trifling and invading an assignment with a deadline crawling up my leg, I agreed. Another motivating factor was that through my virtual snooping, I had learned a lot about his body by way of his many, many thirst traps posted on Instagram. It was Bryce who decided that we could meet at Sexy Taco, weird, long name. He asked for options in Harlem, but with the caveat, "I need a frozen margarita. They're all I drink." He liked dick and diabetes, I guess. We met around 10 that evening. He had just gotten off work at Murdoch's House of Madness, clearly, sexual harassment, allegedly, and propaganda, obviously. The conversation was going pretty okay until that mention of Fox News came up. Sensing my hesitance to dive deeper into his work, he went, I know, but I don't have anything to do with that." He surely did not. After all, he did the anchors' hair, he said, not fill their minds with the drivel they spew. For about 15 minutes, I let him tell stories about various anchors. To the shock of no one, Bill O'Reilly was apparently a racist asshole, and as we would later learn, an accused sexual predator at the workplace, which led to his ultimate ejection. Somewhat surprising to me, Sean Hannity was nice. Wasn't that special? Fuck Sean Hannity was my response to that new nugget of intel. Then the now former Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly came up. When Bryce had learned I was a writer, and a very opinionated one at that, he didn't know how I felt about Kelly, whom he fancied very much. I hated Megyn Kelly. I was raised not to say that I hated anyone, but I was also raised to procreate by way of vaginal sex and holy matrimony. If I could break the rules on that, I could break the rules on declarations of hatred. I fucking hate Megyn Kelly. As Bryce went on and on about what a nice woman she was and how well she treated everyone on set, the forced smile on my face could no longer handle the weight of pretending I harbored nothing but disdain for her. I agree with Bryce that Megyn Kelly's role in helping oust Roger Ailes was a courageous act forever worthy of celebration. However, Megyn Kelly, like Bill O'Reilly, like Sean Hannity, like Tucker Carlson, like those morning simpletons on Fox and Friends, and like just about everyone on that network besides Shepard Smith, followed the Fox News model of stoking racial animus to pander to the old white races who watched the news network in droves. She magnified the new Black Panther Party in ways no sensible news person ever would, because their clout was virtually non-existent within the Black community, to the point where journalists decried her work as a minstrel show. She was a woman who, in 2015, claimed that the Obama administration intended to force two white and two privileged communities to embrace diversity, whether the communities want it or not. That same year, Kelly dismissed a DOJ report that found racial bias and stereotyping within the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department, based on the notion that there are very few companies in America, whether they are public or private, where you won't find any racist emails or inappropriate comments. The same person who once declared that a speech by First Lady Michelle Obama played into a culture of victimization. A woman who invoked racial stereotypes to portray Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor as temperamental. And the woman who, despicably, described a Black girl needlessly tackled by police at a pool party as no saint. Evidence of Kelly's on-air racism was far and wide. I honestly, truly might have gotten over the fact that Bryce had almost cracked the skull of an ex. I could fight, and there was a troop of folks who would swoop in if he had a relapse. I could get with him learning to relax, relate, release, and excel shoop shoop after a brush with the law. But Megyn Kelly? How could he question all the evidence presented before him? He had her hair looking pretty as she said the ugliest shit about us. What about that was not racist and reprehensible? I don't think it's fair to call her racist because you don't know what's in her heart. Oh dear God, you are one of those. Whenever there are accusations of racism leveled against someone likely guilty of being a racist, the peanut gallery would come with the retort that it was hard to gauge another person's racism because we didn't know what was in their heart. I didn't give a fuck what was in her heart. That had nothing to do with whether or not she was a racist. There are levels to racism. In the case of Kelly, stoking racial prejudice for professional gain was a racist act. This drinks thing also happened after the 2016 presidential election, so to that end, I thought of Megyn Kelly as the epitome of the 53% of white women who voted for that man, Sweet Potato Saddam, a white woman willing to sacrifice the humanity of non-whites to preserve her privilege and status. She may not have presented herself in the same way as the loud, cantankerous, vile white men with whom she shared primetime space, but she was guilty of perpetuating the same sins because she delivered the same ugly sentiments about black people on her breath. After explaining all of this, all I got back was the sight of this man slurping from his third frozen sugary-ass margarita and the quip, "I disagree." Then he went to the restroom, and as I watched him walk to and from the bathroom, I wondered if my visible annoyance and monologue had killed the mood. Fine. I didn't have to wonder. I had killed the mood. We changed the subject and talked more about each other, but whatever this was, it had pretty much died. Many advised not talking about politics on dates, but he was half black and it was Megyn Kelly. I had never met a black person in New York City who greeted the topic of Megyn Kelly with a smile and a gush about her not being so bad. I just assumed he did her hair, offered a few hey girls here and there, and then texted his friends like, "I hate her." But when you make assumptions, you sometimes don't get any ass. I never saw him again. I wonder what he thought of me. Like, even though he was the one with the violent past, did he think I was going to break a glass and scream Black Lives Matter at him? I regret nothing. This place is no sanctuary. As a kid, I had jet black hair full of curls. I used to routinely twist my hair in the front into a knot. My sister used to always tease in response to this comforting habit, "Quit doing that, you're gonna go bald." I would always tell her to stop saying that, as it sparked too intense a fear in me. There were some men and women who were stunning bald, but not once had I ever thought my peanut head would allow a similar beauty for me. The end result was me never, ever wanting to go bald or to give the appearance that I was going bald. I tended to obsess over my hair and was particular about the way I believe it ought to look. These were character traits I definitely shared with my father. My earliest memory of barbers was my dad's friend JB, who used to cut in a garage. Ours are his. I like JB a lot. Most of my dad's friends were as loud and rowdy as he was, but there were others like JB who were a lot more chill and measured in their behavior. A necessary counterpoint to the magnetic personality of my pops, a man who didn't know how to be still unless he was sleeping. I also liked JB because he would feign being impressed by me repeating phrases like 360-degree angle. We both knew I had lifted that from professional wrestling commentators, but encouragement was encouragement. I had met so many of my dad's friends over the years. Some stuck around, many others did not. JB did not, but I don't recall ever questioning one of his cuts. After JB, my dad took me up the street to a barbershop located in a plaza that included a hole-in-the-wall club for the old heads, a pawn shop, and a big barbecue pit in the parking lot that used to serve as patrons of all of the above. The place was named Roger's Barbershop. The owner, unsurprisingly named Roger, looked like he used to be in a soul group that opened for the Shy Lights. He never cut me. I went to Ron, another one of my dad's friends. After a few years, Ron moved to another barbershop less than 5 minutes away from the old location. I can't recall the name of that shop, but I do remember that Ron used to wear eyeglasses that suggested he really missed the Run DMC era. Once, Ron cut 3 parts of my hair, and I temporarily hated him for it. I used to keep a part in the front, but I didn't care for that degree of excessiveness. I felt that the money he was owed for that cut should have been spent instead in the McDonald's right across the railroad tracks. RIP to that long demolished location. On a 20-piece nugget and an extra large order of french fries as a reward for the emotional abuse I had just endured over superfluous cuts on the side of my head that I did not ask for. That barbershop closed abruptly, and I never knew where the hell Ron went after that. Maybe it was divine intervention, because who was to say he wouldn't have kept putting unrequested parts on the side of my head? As I sought a replacement barber, my friend Kim introduced me to her brother Gary, who cut my hair at her mom's house. Gary was both an amazing barber and someone amazing to look at. However, despite not knowing